Hey, hey, have you heard? It's your host, Chris DeMakes, and I'm headed back to the Punk Rock Museum. That's right, the powers that be have invited me back, and I couldn't be more excited. Allow me to be your guide as we wind through 5 decades of punk rock history, merchandise, and memorabilia. Cinco de Mayo weekend, Friday, May 3rd, Saturday, May 4th, and Sunday, May 5th. There'll be 2 tours each day at 12:30 p.m. and 4 p.m. And the best part for me is you. Your stories, your questions, your experiences. Yep, some of you old punkers have taught this guy a thing or two on these tours, and I love it. Head over to thepunkrockmuseum.com for tickets. Don't miss out. Only 30 spots per tour. Get your tickets now at thepunkrockmuseum.com.
Hello, everybody. Today's guest is Matt Pryor, lead singer and guitarist for the Kansas City, Missouri-based band, The Get Up Kids. We discuss the song Holiday, which is the lead-off track from their second album, Something to Write Home About. Matt shared how very early on, the band embraced their pop sensibilities and always saw themselves more of a pop band than an emo band. I mentioned to Matt that this record was highly influential when it came out back in 1999, and both the legacy of that record and the countless bands it inspired and influenced is testament to just how strong the songs are. We touched on the mid-90s Kansas City punk rock scene and how that shaped who they were, both as a band and as people. And we both talked about how powerful a perfectly placed pick slide can be if used correctly in a song. For all this and much more, stay tuned.
Hey, hey, have you heard? Chris DeMakes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Chris DeMakes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Chris DeMakes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard?
Well, for the listeners, the Get Up Kids formed in 1995 in Kansas City, Missouri. And Matt, I certainly remember Kansas City in the mid-90s. lots of disenfranchised punk rockers, disenfranchised youth looking for something to do. Of course, there was a venue there. First time we, Les and Jake, ever played in Kansas City was at the Daily Grind. I'm sure you remember that.
Played there many times.
And
saw some of the weirdest shows I've ever seen in my life there. So the craziest one I will tell you is we saw a then unknown No Doubt play with Godhead Silo, that kind of noise band that's from on Sub Pop. It was a weird bill.
Yeah, and those kinds of bills would happen in Kansas City in 1995.
They happened everywhere in the 90s, it feels like.
Yeah. Well, I'm not trying to pick on Kansas City. It was just one of those places.
No, I didn't take it.
No. Just one of those places that had just this incredible scene in the 90s.
Well, it was small. You know what I mean? Like, it was cool, but it was like you were a bunch of different sounding bands would get, you know, thrown together because there wasn't really like a cohesive, like, these are the pop punk bands. And these are the, you know what I mean? Like, it was just sort of like we're all, it's like, hey, you're a weirdo, I'm a weirdo, let's play a show together.
we're all going to get weird together because we're all in this together. Yeah,
right. Well, it's like you're in a ska band, I'm in a metal band, let's play a show.
Well, you know, that time period and you guys, and I don't mean this as a knock in any way, it just seems like I remember the late 90s, it was like you guys just came out of nowhere and it was just like, whoa. And I mean, you were just your sound, just you were one of those bands, and I'm not going to put this tag on you, it's not fair, but your sound transformed into what became known as the emo sound, and tons of bands you know, you were an influence to, and it was just like your name just kept popping up. And this particular record, Something to Write Home About, the song we're going to talk about today is Holiday. And take us back to that time period when you were writing for this record. This was your second record. The first one came out in 97, and this record came out a day before my birthday in 1999. And take us back to when you were writing the song for the record.
Well, okay, so when we were writing, we were going through this process of trying to sign to a new record label. We had wanted to try and sign to a major label, And so we were in this kind of like holding pattern where we weren't touring. We were just writing and waiting and letting like lawyers and managers argue about things and ultimately not really making any progress. And so finally we were just like, look, we have this record written. We want to put it out. And that's when Vagrant was like, well, we'll just do it. And we're like, okay. And so we went out to California and we were in the then very unhip Silver Lake neighborhood. And at Chick Corea, the jazz pianist studio. And yeah, we went and stayed at our friend. Do you know Kevin Kusatsu from back in the day?
Sounds really familiar.
He was of the same era. He was a touring guy back in the day, but okay. It doesn't matter. We stayed at his house, and he apparently had not told his roommates that we were going to be staying there.
That's always
and
fun.
So all of a sudden, there were six of us too. It was just like because we brought our friend Alex to kind of like he was our sound guy for live shows, and we were just like, I don't know what we're getting into. Why don't you come with us, and at least you know what we're supposed to sound like, and. You know, we crashed on the floor at his house for, geez, like 6 weeks, 5 weeks, something like that. And he was in what part of town was he in? I don't even remember. Santa Monica, I think. And then we would drive to Silver Lake and spend all day in the studio. So that was kind of...
Which for our listeners isn't close in LA traffic.
No, no.
That takes
luckily,
forever.
Luckily, we weren't going in till like noon, you know, but that's still like... So it wasn't like rush hour, you know, when you're working from noon to 10 o'clock at night, but it still could get bad.
Well, you touched on something interesting. You know, you had mentioned, you know, we were looking to sign to a major, you know, you had put out one record. Were you getting any, well, two-part question. Were you getting any bites from majors? And the 90s were a weird time, as you know, man, the cries of sellout and everything else. So what was your reasoning for wanting to go to a major at that point?
Well, I mean, we always kind of considered ourselves a pop band first and kind of a punk band second. And again, like we didn't really feel part of, like, we didn't feel like scene ethics. You know what I mean? Like I live and die by Fugazi, but it's still kind of like, well, that's great for them. You know, like, in,
I can totally relate to that.
And you know, we all have to come to terms with what the level of comfort we are in treating this like a business. And for some people, that means putting everything out yourself. And for some people like us, it meant like, well, we're going to stay completely ethical and true to ourselves, but we want to reach as many people as possible. And it seemed like at the time, the only way to really do that was a major label, although that's also around the same time that Epitaph blew up. So it was kind of like, well, okay, maybe that's, which is why I think we were comfortable taking a risk on Vagrant, because it was sort of like, well, I mean, Epitaph, the Offspring had like a huge record, you know, like, and so, yeah, there was interest, but it wasn't good interest. Everyone thought of us as a baby band. And they thought we were super green when we'd been a band for four years and been touring for two, and we're really hardworking and had a proven track record of like people were coming to our shows, people were buying our first album. So we didn't feel like we were getting like the respect that, you know, if we're going to sign a contract like that, that's like a potentially 7-album contract, you don't want to like just take whatever they give you. You want to make sure that you're going to get something good, you know?
Sure. And I think it was kind of cool what you just said too, because certainly, you know, it's a little rough around the edges in terms of a, I hate to call it a punk sound, but you know, but you guys were a pop band. The melodies are pop. It's derived from that. And you kind of saw where you wanted to go with this. And, you know, that was somewhat of a bold move. I never paid attention to it. I was the same position as you. I just wanted to sell as many records and reach as many people as we could. And ultimately it was all about the live show. And I'm sure for you guys too, we just wanted to play to more people.
Yeah, absolutely. And we would always kind of refer to ourselves as an indie rock band. That was sort of like what we listened to for the most part, but it was like, we liked melody, you know what I mean? And we weren't super angry. So we didn't have a whole lot of like screamy shit. Oh wait, can I swear on this? Is that
you can
okay?
swear all, you can swear all you want. Yeah. The more you do, the less I do.
Fuck yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting. Like I did a podcast the other day and I was talking to, it was a kind of a co-interview with my friend Chris from Mineral, who we toured with a couple times, but it was just kind of like, we couldn't sound more different than that band, but we're both called second wave emo or whatever. But it's just like, it's very different. And like, I think that is like, we felt like of our contemporaries, it's like Jimmy Eat World and the Promise Ring were the ones that we were just like, oh yeah, this makes sense to me. Like these are, I mean, the Promise Ring are just basically hooks. Like just kind of like, it's like, even if it's just, he's saying like one line over and over again in the song, it's still like a great hook, you know?
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, in journalists, they had to put tags on things. I mean, we got lumped in with the ska bands and we were
it's a marketing term, you know?
Sure, sure. Well, I distinctly remember this record coming out and you guys just had such a great buzz, but it's testament to the songs because I almost think, and I actually went back and watched your 2009 anniversary show that you played back home. You played the record and it was just incredible.
At Liberty Hall.
Liberty Hall. And it just seems like the legacy of the band is so much bigger than what it even was then.
That's an interesting thing to think about.
At least the legacy of this record.
Yeah, I mean, conceptually, I think I agree with you, but it's hard for me to admit that. You know what I mean? Like, what we were doing was really important and still is important to this day. It's like, I can't.
Well, you can't say that, but I can. And it really was. It really was. And this track we're going to talk about, Holiday, was the leadoff song. And going back, do you remember if this was it specifically written for the record, or was this a hold off from the first album? Did you write the song on the road? Where were you at when you wrote it?
I think we were just at our disgusting practice space in downtown Kansas City. That's now like a really high end loft. We would just get together and, you know, and practice and write. The only stuff that was like carryover from previous things, there's a song called Red Letter Day and a song called I'm a Loner, Dottie, a Rebel that were both on different versions of them were on previous releases, but everything else was, fresh, that we wrote kind of in that same time period. And I don't really remember writing Holiday specifically. I mean, I remember writing like the lyrics and stuff, but I don't really remember if it was like an aha moment other than doing the pick slide at the front of it.
Oh, you're talking about, I wanted to talk about the pick slide. That's the first thing I was going to talk about. That's amazing.
Well, there's two things to it. One is that when you put a pick slide like that at the beginning of a song to introduce a song, it's like, well, this has to be the first song on the record. Cause like, that doesn't make any sense anywhere else, you know, like, but then, so our friend Eddie, who has been our guitar tech, he, the first time he met, so he worked for that band Spoon, and Rob, our bass player, used to play in Spoon.
Wow.
And when he first met Eddie, Eddie goes, he was kind of drunk. He's like, you're in the Get Up Kids? And Rob goes, yeah. And he goes, one pick slide to rule them all.
Well, you know, I was going to say, this is the perfect track to open a record. It opens with a pick slide, and you said it for me, Matt. The song opens with...
It's so gratuitous. It's such a like heavy metal move, you know, like...
Yeah, that's what I loved. And it's funny. I hadn't listened to the track in a while. And in past couple of days, I've been really, you know, getting back into it and listening to it and critiquing it. And that was one of the first things I noticed. I'm like, I don't remember that pick slide back in the day, but son of a bitch, that's awesome.
It's like eight pick slides. Yeah. It's like that was, cause that was in the kind of like Foo Fighters Color in the Shape era. And it was like, oh, well, it means we got to quadruple each guitar track with different amps and like, you know what I mean? Like, it was just like, we got to build this like really fat sound, which you don't need to do. You can do that with one guitar track, but
the things we didn't know then.
Right. But so it's just like, all right, pick slide take 7. Okay, here we go. And
well, after the pick slide happens, it comes in for 2 measures with just this really, really catchy octave guitar part. And then we get into the first verse that I'd like to talk about.
Okay.
The song itself is 3 minutes and 30 seconds. And it's interesting, you know, 3 minutes and 30 seconds isn't that long of a song. It's typically what you'd hear on the radio, 3.5 minutes. But this song feels a lot faster than that. I was surprised. It felt like it's 2.5 minute song. It goes by really quick. And I think that's testament to great songwriting, and it goes by quickly because all the parts are great. The first verse is, "What became of everyone I used to know? Where did our respectable convictions go? Your words don't match the story that your actions show. What do I know?" So set that up for us.
There's a couple of different things thematically on the record as a whole that are just kind of like me kind of like having opinions about stuff, but then sort of going, like, it's sort of like a snapshot to just the things I was thinking about at the time. Like, if when you brought this up and said, you want to do this song or Action in Action, I was just like, well, Action in Action is really hard to explain because it's kind of meandering. Like, it doesn't really have a point. It's just things that were in my head. But this one is like, so I had a friend that I was in a band with when I was in high school, and he moved to Chicago. And we fell out of touch. And then whenever I would see him again, like, this hard thing. And I'm sure that, you know, all of our bands have had this where, like, other people in other bands kind of treat you like you're just not very cool. You know, like, you're just sort of like you get kind of like indie rock snobbery kind of stuff from people. And
Matt, I play in a ska band. Okay.
No, I was trying to dance around that.
You want to talk about getting picked on? We're the last one to get picked for the kickball team and everything, you know.
No, I'm glad you said it. I wasn't going to come out and say it. Well, I'm in an emo band, so we're both pussies. But it was just kind of this like what happened to you, man? You know? And then it was like, but maybe it's me, you know, like maybe I'm the one who's changed, and I'm coming at this from a weird perspective. And then you know, the chorus is just sort of like, it's about basically the end of a friendship, or a perceived end of a friendship. And like, kind of like, maybe I'll see you when you come home for Christmas or whatever, you know? And,
well, yeah, so, we're gonna get there in a second. So just the first verse here. So yeah, now I can see kind of what you're saying. It's like, you know, what became of everyone I used to know? Where did our respectable convictions go? Your words don't match the story that your actions show. So it sounds like there's a little bit of disconnect with your friends at this point.
Yeah, I don't know that I would still continue to ever write the words, "Where did your respectable convictions go?" That sounds very like, I mean, I was 2021 when I wrote that, and it sounds very, it's very judgy, you know, like it's very like it's basically me calling somebody a sellout kind of, and I don't even know what I meant by that necessarily. It just kind of worked there, and it kind of expressed the tone, if not being completely accurate of how I was feeling.
You know, it's so funny. You just reminded me of something. I had someone on the other day that was very embarrassed about lyrics to this particular song that they wrote back when they were 20. And, you know, I've felt that way over the years. And then I'll get on stage, or I'll have that fan come up after the show and say, "That lyric in, you know, in Holiday, where did our respectable convictions go? That,
yeah,
I got,
right.
Look, I got the tattoo on my left bicep," you know? And it's those moments that make you realize that, yeah, I was 21, 22, but look how it's still touching people, you know?
Well, yeah. And like, I definitely have that, you know, when someone, and you know, and our albums before that, we were teenagers, and like people get the lyrics of the songs tattooed on their chests or whatever. And it's like, okay, well, but it's kind of, I always tell people whenever like non-musicians ask, like, "What's it like playing like the same songs every night? Do you ever get sick of it?" And I go, "Well, I get sick of rehearsing them, but like once you're on stage and everyone's singing along and you can see how happy you're making them, then I don't even think about it." You know, like it's just sort of, other than if my voice hurts. And then I'm just like you said Holiday goes by so fast. And for me, it absolutely does not, because I have to like scream like the whole time.
Yeah, there is a lot of words. There's a lot of singing in this. That
is
true.
There's a lot of words, and it's at the top of my range. So it's just like, and like, but then everybody's working pretty hard. The bass line's really fast. There's that big drum fill in the bridge that every time we do it, I look at Ryan and wait for him to fuck it up. Because I'm just like, it's a hard fill.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, going into the pre-chorus, so let's break this down a little bit. I'm sure you can't I'm sure you can't help but remembering. Thought that you'd be one not to forget. Remembering is not helping you yet.
Yeah, I mean, again, just sound kind of pissed off that my friend was kind of had left and was kind of like like in my, you know, interpretation, like kind of dissing me.
Well, now, do you remember what that was about, like in the respect of, were they dissing you because you had kind of become something and become known where you're from? Was it from a standpoint of jealousy?
I don't know. I mean, it's possible. We were already starting to do fairly well at that point. So, mm-hmm. I mean, that could be part of it. I personally never really understood that, but like, so I don't know. I guess for all intents and purposes, I just felt slighted, and I don't know that I was even thinking about what their perspective actually was. I was just sort of like kind of telling them to fuck off, really.
Yeah. Well, and I've felt that over the years, and I can only, I guess, understand it from, you know, I've met whatever you want to call them, rock stars over the years when I was younger, and I'd meet them and I would say things that I was just starstruck. They'd be standing there like, I don't know, at a grocery store or something. I'd be like, what are you doing here? And they're like, getting some mac and cheese. What are you doing here? Mm-hmm. You know, because we tend to put people that we admire on a pedestal. And they think that you've changed, but in reality, you're just the same dude. You're just known a little bit more because of what you do.
I mean, for me, I think that's certainly the case. I think I have seen some people that were just like, you know, you get to a certain level of success and you're like, man, you really are concerned about this thing. That's really, I have this thing, this sort of like mantra that like, if we're going to go on tour and do this weird job, we really need to like celebrate that we get to go to all these places and actually go see them and not just stay backstage the whole time, but then B, to just celebrate the absurdity of what it is that we're doing. And so
that's a great point.
But it's like you want to take it seriously enough that you're still, you know, playing well and performing and giving people a good night out. But then at the same time, it's just like, this is just a party, dude. Like, this is not like, and yeah, you have bad nights when you can't, the monitors are shit or whatever, but it's just like, for the most part, just get through it and be a ham and have fun and all that. And so I have real low tolerance for people, especially musicians who get like shitty to people. Mm-hmm. Like, and I see it primarily when like, it's like at a festival or something like that. And, you know, or the way they treat like house crew people and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
Or the way some people treat their own road crew. And I'm just like, you can't do this without these people. So, you know, yeah. I don't know, buy him dinner, you know.
Yeah, no, you got to remember where you came from, and you have to, yeah, I've always prided less than Jake on that. We've always tried to be really cool to anybody, backstage people, our bus driver, whoever, it's because you're all out on the road together. You're all out there living it. You're away from home. You're missing holidays, no pun intended. You're missing birthdays, weddings, funerals, and everything else, you know. So I totally get that. I want to get into the chorus. I love this chorus for a couple reasons. I feel like you're getting two choruses in one, and the back half of it, I wouldn't consider a post chorus. It's just the back half of the chorus, but it's so neat because I would never think of melding a whole chorus as having like what I'm going to refer to as the heavy rock part for the first half, and then it goes into this slower kind of arpeggiated guitar part for the second half. Say goodnight, mean goodbye.
Speaking of-
the lyric is "Say Goodnight." And you are pretty up there vocal range wise here. This is pretty.
Yeah, tell me about it.
Pretty up there. "Say goodnight, mean goodbye. Know you think my life would stop when you're away. Maybe I can see you on holiday." On the word "away" there, that when the vocal melody changes and it goes to that C sharp minor chord, I love that. It's like a goosebump moment. And then we get into the back half where that arpeggiated slower guitar part comes in, and the lyric is "worlds away. I've never forgotten all our yesterdays. I'm lucky if we're speaking on the holidays." Now, I know that Chad Blinman and Alex Brawl produced this record. Where did they come in? And I want to kind of bring them in right now, because this is a very strange chorus to me. Was there ever talk of like, we can't have the second half of the chorus be slow like this, because it's just not typical? How did that come about, and did they have any say in that?
I don't remember.
It's very
that
different.
Really being an issue. I see what you mean. We always kind of in a kind of like Pixies / Nirvana, like tried to experiment with like the quiet loud kind of dynamics, and that was a big part of like the scene that we came up in with like bands like Boys Life and you know, even Jimmy Eat World and their earlier stuff. And
but if anything, you're going to start the chorus off with the first part, have it slow and get.
Yeah, I'm not sure why we decided to do that. I mean,
we have
a lot of weird songs. If you go back and like listen to like our first record, there's like 2 minute long instrumentals before it even gets to the first words in the song, and just like or like all this like strange stuff. So it doesn't. Like, I think this is maybe where we first started to kind of experiment with like standard pop song structure. But then I don't think it even registered to us that was a weird thing at the time to like, but I see what you're saying though, is that you're coming in hot and then bringing it down.
Yeah.
As opposed to the other way around.
You typically don't do that for a chorus. And that's why I had asked about the producers. Do you remember how involved they were with song structures or suggesting, hey, maybe we should double this chorus or double this part or take this part away?
Not really. I mean, they were more on the engineering side than the the producer side. We really kind of the song structure and all that stuff was kind of all us, and just trying to like, you know, try different things and I mean, I think that we've tried to varying degrees of success to like try not to repeat ourselves too often. And we wanted Something Right Home About to sound different than 4 Minute Mile did, you know, because we weren't happy with how 4 Minute Mile turned out. And so we wanted big guitars and stuff. But like, yeah, it's interesting. I don't think we even – I think there's other songs that have that same sort of like dynamics, but probably not as striking as that. It is interesting. I remember reading an interview with Metallica or seeing an interview with them where they were talking about that song – Unforgiven,
right?
And
yeah,
how it's loud in the verse and quiet in the chorus, and they just thought they had fucking invented fire, you know, like they just were like
I do remember hearing that song though, Matt, when it came out, and I remember thinking this is different. I'm not going to say they invented that by any means, but it was a little different. But their whole chorus was slow. This is a double chorus here. The back half of the chorus, it almost just sounds like a completely different part, but it's still the chorus, and it's just it's cool. It's cool songwriting. I don't think that if I sat down and tried to do that I could get it to work. It's really cool.
I think it's also kind of interesting because like, yeah, it's only really kind of comes down in that part of the chorus.
Well, it comes down. And so the first part is still heavy to maybe I can see you on, and then boom, right when you say holidays, that's when it changes. Right there.
Yeah, that's a fun one to do live because everybody screams that, and so I don't even sing it anymore. I just let the crowd take it.
Well, if you keep going, I might get to it because this song's so high, you might have to have the whole crowd sing the whole thing.
Well, I've had nights like that, man.
So have I.
It's like, can we play Holiday Night? I'm like, no. I'm like, why not? Because I can't. If I sing it, it'll be bad. You know, like I can't hit. I want to do that for you, but. Yeah.
I got Denver and Salt Lake and, you know, San Francisco coming up. I'll never make those shows if I do it tonight.
Yeah. If it was Roadie Friday, then sure. You know, and I can have a day off tomorrow, then.
Hey there, I am Johnny Christ from Avenged Sevenfold, and I've got a podcast called Drinks with Johnny you're going to want to check out. I sit down with a bunch of different people from all different walks of life, from professional wrestlers to actors, comedians, fighters, musicians, everything in between. I'm just looking to make some friends and have a good time doing it. So if that sounds like something you're into, go check out Drinks with Johnny, streaming everywhere now.
We can play for 4 hours if you want. I don't care.
So after the first chorus, we come back into a re-intro, which is two measures. It's the same as the top of the song, although there's no pick slide here. Sorry to disappoint everybody. No pick.
Well, I mean, that would just be gauche to go back and do a pick slide again.
Yeah, you can't have the pick slide there. I'm just teasing.
Fire that gun in the beginning and you can't really reload it.
Point taken. The second verse comes in after the re-intro, and the lyric is, "The evidence presents itself accusingly, your absence speaking everything you think of me. Now that I am faced with opportunity, you're not remembering."
It's heavy on the Scrabble words, you know, like it's very like very thesaurus-y.
Is accusingly a word?
I think accusingly can accusingly? Be, I mean, I said it, so yeah.
You sang it with conviction, and I believed it, so.
I've made up words before to put into songs, so that's not that weird. But yeah, I mean, it does, I think maybe that's one of the things about this song that like, it makes me cringe a little bit, because it does kind of sound like, I read books. You know, like I know big words.
Yeah, but it's not like Greg Graffin or something. You know, I mean, you get it.
Well, right. No, I'm also not a professor. So,
but is this the second verse? Is this a building on what was going on in the first verse? Or
yeah,
okay,
it's all part of the same plot.
And in your mind, you're still kind of feeling these things with the friends, and it's still kind of like, you know, it says the last line in this verse is, "You're not remembering." So you remember what that was actually about, saying you're not remembering like who I was or who we were or the times we had.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I mean, cause this was someone that I, you know, had played music with and had, you know, teenage experiences with. That sounded sexual. That's not what I meant. But like, you know, and it just kind of felt blown off, and which I think is something that's common at that age. Like I often refer to it, like I didn't go to college, but my touring years in my 20s were like my college years. And so I think that's a pretty common experience when someone that you're tight with in high school moves away and, you know, the relationship kind of falls off. And that's not necessarily bad, but, you know, it can feel hurt by it.
Does the person that the song was written about, do they know that it's about them?
I don't think so.
No?
Okay. I've only had that happen twice.
Yeah. That can either be a really great thing or a complete bummer.
Well, it either means that I'm really clever or I'm really obtuse. You know, like it's probably the latter. But that's also part of it too, is that like, so there, one of the times that someone figured out the song was about them, I felt horrible, because I felt like, and there's a song on Something at Home About called My Apology. Mm-hmm. That's kind of about that. That's just sort of like, look, I just sing about what I'm thinking about. And I was pissed at you at the time, but I also have to remember that like other people are going to hear this and it's going to live for, you know, all of eternity or whatever. So I think I was sort of like, that's where it gets into that kind of questioning myself in Holiday of just kind of like, well, what do I know? Maybe I'm just, you know, taking this too seriously, and you know what I mean?
Yeah. And well, that's what I wanted to ask too. You reminded me. So that lyric in the chorus, I'm lucky if we're speaking on the holidays, because holiday time to me, even to this day, you know, it always kind of meant going home, back where you're from, to your parents' hometown. And you would run into people during the holidays. And that's kind of what I took from this.
That's what I was implying.
Yeah.
I don't know that we ever really, like, it was just kind of a meaningful metaphor in that sense of just like, I don't think we ever really hung out on the holidays ever. If he even came home for the holidays, or yeah. If I was ever home for the holidays, you know, like, but yeah, it's that kind of like, oh, guess I'll see you when you go visit your parents back in, you know,
yeah, for Thanksgiving
Philly or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the second pre-chorus, the lyrics change here. They're not the same. The second pre-chorus is, I'm not asking you anyway, and even if you ever could cave in, I wouldn't know where to begin.
So yeah, that's me kind of like second guessing myself of just like, even it, part of me was like, even if you did call me, I'm not sure that I would know what to talk to you about. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
So this is at least partially on me too. And I'm kind of trying to be cognizant of that, even though I don't necessarily, maybe understand it again. I was so young.
I can totally respect that from being a younger songwriter at some point. I get it. I used the example the other day of, it's the picture you drew when you were a kid that your mom still has hung up on the wall, you know, and she shows people, hey, look what Matt drew when he was five. You're like,
can I extrapolate on that?
I tell people,
you remember the poetry you wrote when you were 17? Imagine, you know, and how bad that was and how, you know, emo that was. Imagine if that was your first album and everybody loved it and you just felt like, oh.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? Well, it's funny because, and I always talk about it on the show, about how memories are attached to songs. You know, I know you've gotten better. I think I've gotten better as a songwriter. You learn more. You grow as you get older. But the newer songs I write, I want everyone to love them, and I want as much as they do the old stuff. But they don't have the 20 or 25 years of memories attached to them.
Yeah,
you can never.
You know, I was thinking. I actually was thinking about this the other day because I'm trying to think. Are there any other art forms, although maybe food, of like it causes sense memory like that? You know, like if you see a painting, you don't remember, oh, we used to smoke weed in the back of the pickup truck and look at the moon. But if you hear, you know, if you hear a song that you were listening to at that time, it automatically takes you back there. And I think it's a really,
yeah, if there's a certain smell, you're like, that smells like my grandma's basement or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's
I don't think I get that from other art forms. That's not to say that like they're bad necessarily. Maybe some TV shows that you watched when you were a kid. Could mm-hmm. be like that. Like the way people talk about Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Just kind of go like, all right, if it's really that important to you.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't, I get that. I sometimes it's weird. And this podcast is weird in a sense, because you're talking about songs and in a lot of instances, there's stuff that people wrote so long ago. And mm-hmm. just the fact that you even remember half the stuff you're telling me about it was so long ago. It's like, you know, but it takes you back. The second chorus here is the same as the first chorus, except at the very end, you repeat holidays twice. And then it goes into this bridge that kind of comes out of nowhere, which is kind of the heaviest part of the song. The drums kind of go double time. Mm-hmm. The guitars just get big there. And the synthy keyboard is really prominent in this part. And there's a this drum snare kind of build up. There's no lyrics here at all. Do you remember that part in the sense of you know, was there ever a discussion of having lyrics, or we need lyrics here, or was it just going to be a musical buildup?
I don't remember ever discussing it, but I think we all felt that it didn't need it. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like it kind of feels like the drums, particularly in that part, are so interesting because it's just this like tightrope walk.
They really are.
Just like, how is he going to do that? You know, we've since taken that and done it with other songs. Like there was a song on our last record that I had written lyrics to a bridge, and they were just like, let's not that the lyrics are bad, but like let's let it breathe, you know, and like have, because that's the thing about holidays. It's just like vocally, it's like the stabbing scene in Psycho. It's just like.
Well,
and
I was,
so that's the only time.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, if anything, this is a. And I'm sure when it gets to this part, you're like, thank God, I get a break for like, you know.
Oh yeah, and then I feel bad for Ryan because that's like the hardest part of the song for him on the drums. So.
Yeah, no, it is a much needed break, and I think it's great that there's no lyrics here because the song I feel needed to breathe. the last chorus.
There is a part. There's a part to that bridge, though. If I can just like a composing note that I thought of. So, you know, it goes into that. It's got like a hiccup when it goes into the chorus after it comes out of that big drum fill.
Yeah,
which like say good night like that. And I really wanted it to be more of a pronounced like pause, kind of like in a. I think of it in like Screeching Weasel, kind of. It's just like back a back a back a back boom, like it's like a pause going into the thing, mm-hmm. And everybody was like, "No, that's a dumb idea." I was just like, "Aw," and then now I'm so glad it doesn't have it. Like I'm just kind of like I would feel so. I don't know. It's an interesting thing.
That's a really interesting, and that's a great point because I've thought about that more times. It's what you just laid out to where I think back and go, oh yeah, I really wanted to change that lyric to this. I'm so glad I didn't. Very few times is it, we should have doubled that chorus at the end. We were idiots. You know, it's usually the first thing you said.
You know, hindsight's 20/20, I guess.
Yeah. This last chorus is interesting because it comes out of this bridge and you know the chorus is coming and boom, your the vocal goes straight through the roof again. It's up there in your register. You're screaming it. It's heartfelt. Say goodnight, mean goodbye. Know you think my life would stop when you're away. I'm lucky if we're speaking on holidays, and you say it twice. But there's no slow second half to this chorus. It just ends with the heavy part. Do you remember ever having discussion of, well, wait a second, we're not completing the chorus here?
Huh. No, not really. Okay. I mean, it kind of felt like, you know, even weirder than having a quiet back half of the chorus the first two times. It felt like it would completely neuter the song to like end it down. You know what I mean? Like,
what about doubling the song with the chorus heavy twice? Was there ever that discussion, or was it always just once?
I think we probably tried it twice because I think that is part of our collective songwriting instinct is to have double, you know, it's verse, chorus, bridge, double chorus out. And
because that would make more sense than going back to the slow part for sure. Like you said, in neutering the whole thing.
Yeah, but I think it just felt redundant and it was just sort of like, let's just go. It's our third chorus. You know what I mean? Like, so we've made the point, you know what I mean? Like it's just sort of,
yeah.
And so I think it was just like, it felt like it was more impactful just to go out like short and sweet, you know? Plus, we're just all exhausted by that point. It's a hard song to play.
Right. Well, and of course, now we know why the track was picked first. There was nowhere else to put the pick slide on the record. So it had to be the mm-hmm. leadoff track, which it works beautifully in the leadoff position.
It definitely makes a statement for sure. Like, you know, like, and that was the other thing I liked about it too. It's like, you know what kind of a record you're getting into mm-hmm. based on the opening chord and pick slide of the song.
Now this is of course before the days of YouTube and everything was instantaneously on the internet. Do you remember playing Holiday before you recorded it? Do you remember playing it to a live audience?
I don't, it's possible, but I don't remember that.
Okay.
I don't remember if we did or not. And I know there's a couple of shows that we played in California after we made the record where we may have played it. But we tend to like not do that very often where like if we've written a new song, you know, we'll kind of like wait till people have a chance to hear it before we spring it on them. That's not always the case. But
well, that's
sometimes.
The second thing I want to discuss. So do you remember when it was finally recorded, the record's out? Do you remember at least maybe the first couple shows or the first show that you played Holiday and what that audience reaction was like?
No, I bet we weren't even opening with it. Would be my guess because we used to open with the first song on our first record usually, and that was one that people knew.
We talked about getting together for this. It was either this song or Action in Action, and I was because I always thought Action in Action was your biggest track, but you know, this one has the most, you know, Spotify, most YouTube plays Holiday. And what is your, you know, if you can reflect back on a song that you wrote 22 years ago, what is the reasoning for that, that it's resonated with your fans like this so much, this particular track?
Well, the cynical answer to that is something that someone from a record label told me that is like your first track from your album always gets the most plays because of the way Spotify works.
Okay, that's a point taken. Yeah, I guess I think also, and I didn't mention that Chris, my producer, he went ahead and did a little something. We've never done this before on the show. He sent like 10 or 12 texts out to people. So which song, Action X or Holiday? And Holiday was unanimous. So I would dare to say this is probably one of your most fan favorite tracks.
I would agree with that, and I think it's kind of a breakup song, but it's not like obvious. It's not like a sad. It's not like a sad song. I think it's kind of angry, honestly, about it. And I think that's a universal kind of feeling that like everybody can relate to it at some point in their life. And then if you're going to compare it to Action in Action, the lyrics in Action are really obtuse and weird and just kind of random. Except in the chorus. And so I think this Holiday probably is more easily digestible in that sense.
A little more lyrically you can hold on to with it.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, there's another song we have on the record called Red Letter Day that is the one that I think people get tattoos of the most, that is kind of a similar tone of just being angry. Like it's usually like the joke is for you're in an emo band, quote unquote, you're just writing these like sad love songs about a girl that, you liked who didn't like you back. And I was really writing about like the ending of friendships more than with other, people that I grew up with, or not ending them, but, them mm-hmm. changing, I guess, and being frustrated about that.
Yeah, but everyone takes something a little bit different from lyrics, so they can think that this totally. Is about a girl or about them or about whatever life situation they're going through, which is why I love talking about songwriting. Matt, we're gonna wrap up here in a second. I want to a couple okay. things. I want to thank you for taking the time out of your day to be on the yeah, podcast, man. And just want to congratulate you and the guys on all your success and continued success. Like I was saying at the top of the show, you guys definitely have influenced a ton of bands, and that's something to really be proud of.
Well, thanks, man. I appreciate it. This was fun.
No problem. And is there anything you'd like to leave the listeners with? You'd like to plug anything, Matt Pryor solo or the Get Up Kids? Now would be the time.
Well, we're hopefully announcing soon. It's our 25th birthday next month. This month now, I guess. It's October. And we're going to try and do like a live stream sort of celebration of that okay. later on this month. We're just starting to write some more, so that's where we're at.
Very cool. Well, once again, thank you so much, and have a wonderful rest of your day.
All right, you too, man.
Hi, I'm Daniela Clark.
I'm Barbara Ann Wild,
and we are the Honest AF Show.
Our podcast is real, honest conversation with our celebrity friends and pros.
Covering our anything but average rock and roll lifestyles.
All while tackling the hell that is aging and the battle of beauty.
Oh yeah, nothing is off the table.
The Honest AF Show is available wherever you get your podcasts.
As we near the end of the show, here's a band you might not know.
Welcome to this week's Band You Might Not Know. If you'd like your band to be considered for Krista Makes a Podcast, all you have to do is submit your song and bio to bandyoumightnotknow@gmail.com. This week's featured band is The Challenged, a pop-punk band from New York City. You can find them online at thechallenged.com. And this was taken from their new record of the same name. Here's a snippet of their song, Wall Fighter.
The Wrap with Chris and Chris.
This was a personal, really awesome episode for me because a lot of times we talk about in the wrap, or you talk about in the episodes, how people have memories attached to certain songs or certain albums. And Something to Write Home About, Get Up Kids album, is one of those albums that just defines my early 20s and was just always playing whether it was in the car or at a party, and all my friends loved it and I loved it. And I really wanted to hear you talk about the opening track of one of my all-time favorite albums. I think Holiday's an amazing song. And I love that you guys right off the bat started talking about what may be, in my life, the most iconic pick slide ever.
Yeah, he brought it up before I did, which I thought was funny because I had that in the notes. I was like, pick slide, top of the song. That's how it starts, you know?
Right.
And it just lends itself to being the first track on the record. I think Matt got a little bit, I don't want to say embarrassed, but, you know, he's was showing some modesty when I was saying how influential this band is. I can't tell you how many bands cite Get Up Kids as an influence. And even if they didn't cite it or admit to it, you can just hear it in their music. It's countless bands that even went on to more commercial success than Get Up Kids. You can hear that they were a huge influence on them.
Absolutely. Something to write home about for me, especially in our world of music, is easily one of my favorite albums ever. And to hear Matt talk about just how you talk about your mom has that picture you drew when you were 5 and it's embarrassing. And to hear Matt talk about this being an early album for them, and he brought up, you know, the poetry you wrote when you were 17 that's cheesy and now instead picture that's an album and everybody loves it. Well, if that's the poetry that Matt Pryor is writing when he's 17 or 21 or 22 or whatever it is, it's pretty fucking good. And I would not be one bit embarrassed by that. I think it's funny he was talking about, and I know that I've been guilty of this, maybe you've been guilty of it too, that sort of thesaurus type of lyrics where you're using words that aren't often used in songs. Hey, and by the way, Chris, real quick, accusingly is a word. I actually looked that up. But I think that's awesome. You cited also Bad Religion are great for that. But I think that's really cool when you can make words that aren't normally in songs sing so fluently and naturally. I think that's awesome, man. So yeah, Matt's modest about it, but I believe this is a flawless album, both musically and lyrically.
Yeah, you know, and I think when you look, most artists I've found in the podcast and outside of the podcast that I've talked to over the years, they're never so much embarrassed about the song that they wrote. When they speak of the being embarrassed about their early songs, they're mostly speaking about the lyrical content and where they were at then. You know, they feel like, well, I was just this naive kid and I didn't really know anything, and they were just stream of consciousness lyrics. They didn't really mean anything, and I would have done it different now. But I always try to stress to them that you can't ever go back and replace that primal instinct of being that young. And just the proof's in the pudding. Look at I told Matt, I went and looked at their anniversary show in 2009. They played at Liberty Hall in Lawrence for the Something to Write Home About record. And everyone in that place screaming the lyrics to Holiday. They're feeling every lyric that he wrote when he was 21 years old.
Absolutely, man. And I have some very fond memories myself in the mid 2000s. Actually, Alex Brawl, one of the producers of the album who you brought up in this episode, managed Punchline for a while. And Punchline was actually on what was at the time the farewell tour for the Get Up Kids. We were on like the California leg of that and some other shows. And it was like magical for me because they're one of my favorite bands. And this was their final tour ever, which ended up not being. They ended up reuniting a few years later. But still, it was amazing to be a part of that. And, you know, another really funny thing that I wanted to bring up real quick is, so Holiday, I pushed for this. And like you said in the episode, I texted my friends, said, hey, which song? They all said Holiday. And maybe it's because it's that opening track that just gets you psyched up. And obviously the song that the Get Up Kids opened with for years. But years later, Punchline was asked to be part of a Get Up Kids tribute album. And so, of course, we snatched up Holiday. We're like, we want to do Holiday. But we didn't want to do it exactly how the Get Up Kids did it. So we did, it's an interesting choice, but we basically did like an island version of it, for lack of a better way to put it. It sounds very much like what you would listen to at a beach where there's a tiki bar.
You guys are from Pittsburgh, Chris.
I know. And looking back, it's a little bit ridiculous, but I'm really happy with it. But I know that, you know, maybe that year or the next year, Steve had talked to Matt Pryor about it and was like, yo, did you hear our version of Holiday? And Matt was like, yeah, I heard it. And then I think Steve pushed him a little further and he's like, so what'd you think? And he's like, I thought, what the fuck is this? Which something along those lines, which, you know, maybe some people will get offended, but I think that's actually really funny.
Looking back on Punchline's career, Chris, be honest, was that a hit or a miss?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. I stand by it, man.
You gotta play a snippet of the track here in the rap for the fans. Come on.
Absolutely. Hey, I think that a lot of people that listen to this are like ska fans. I think they're going to dig it.
Coming to Jimmy Buffett's beach bar, a rum and bar grill near you, Punchline.
Say good night, mean goodbye.
We've never been afraid to do that kind of stuff. And this all leads to one more thing that Matt said that I believe, I know you, that the guy who dressed up in a million costumes and it was so funny and had so much fun with what you're doing. And I know Punchline does the same thing, but I love that Matt said that he likes to celebrate the absurdity of what we're doing. And it's true, man. We laugh about this all the time, whether it's before a show or in the van, or maybe, you know, maybe we had a few drinks or whatever. Laugh about the fact that for a career, for like our entire lives, we pick up these wooden instruments and we get up on a stage and we sing and dance. And that's just fucking ridiculous, but it is awesome. So you got to like realize that it's a party. And it's one of the greatest things about life to be able to do that.
Oh yeah. The older that I get, I feel that more than I've ever felt it. I'm more appreciative of it now than I ever have. Cause it is absurd. It's, you know, you're driving around in a tube with, sometimes 8, 9, 10 other guys with your crew members and, showing up to a venue and getting on a stage and there's people staring at you and here you are doing your thing. It's definitely not lost on me.
It's easy if you're on a tour and you're tired and you're 3 weeks into the tour to take it for granted for a minute that rooms full of people every night want to watch your band and sing along. It might be easy. I know you don't. I don't really either, but I see how it could be easy to take it for granted. But dude, we are lucky to be able to do that and have people care. And that's why I loved when Matt said that, celebrating the absurdity of what we're doing. That's my favorite moment of that episode.
Well, Chris, there are a lot of absurd things that go around here on Krista Makes a Podcast. But one thing that isn't absurd is our monthly fundraiser. And this month is Hope for the Day. It's a nonprofit movement whose mission is to empower the conversation on proactive suicide prevention and mental health education. Their focus is raising the visibility of resources, providing education, and mobilizing people to take action. Please, if you can, go to KristaMakesADifference.com and donate whatever you can spare, a dollar or two. It's going to a wonderful organization. This is our fundraiser for the month of November, Hope for the Day.
Yeah, and not only are you contributing to a great organization, but also the very nice people over at Hope for the Day will be giving away some hoodies and other merch items to some people at random who donate. So you have a chance to win some cool stuff too. So I would say you should absolutely go to KristaMakesADifference.com right now. I don't even care if you're driving. If you're driving, it doesn't matter. You can text it. No, don't do that. Don't do that.
Well, they can pull over. Yeah, pull over.
Pull over, goddammit. And go to KristaMakesADifference.com and donate a buck or donate $100, whatever you can give to Hope for the Day, because it's a great great cause.
And yeah, and I want to thank all the listeners who have given the past a couple months. Thank you so much for your generosity. Holidays are coming soon. If you're looking for stocking stuffers, I have a new book coming out December 8th. We're taking pre-orders now at ChrisDemakesABook.com. All kinds of cool stuff that comes with this. We got a 7-inch with a couple songs, a poster, t-shirts, a calendar. And Chris, you have some stocking stuffers as well.
Yeah, I literally have an Etsy shop full of stocking stuffers. If you go to iloveenamelpins.com, that takes you to my Etsy shop that has close to 80 different designs of enamel pins. I have everything from dogs and cats to celebrities. Like, if you need a Jeff Goldblum pin, come see me. If you need a Bjork pin, come see me. I'll hook you up. I'll hook you up if you pay for them. But the good thing, speaking of hooking up, is if you use the discount code ChrisDemakes upon checkout at iloveenamelpins.com, you're going to get 30% off your order. That's right. I'm using ChrisDemakes' name to get 30% off of my Etsy shop.
And you don't even have a pin of me yet. I'm offended. Jeez, Chris.
I know, man. I know. I'm slacking.
I'm not as big as Bjork, I guess. That's just what that tells me.
You'll get there.
Yeah, someday. And, I almost forgot. New Less Than Jake record out. Another great stocking stuffer. December 11th, 2020. It's called Silver Linings. So check that out. And if you haven't already, please join the Chris DeMakes a Podcast Facebook group. Lots of fun. Lots of great interaction in there with the fans. It's a blast. Until then, we'll see you next week.
Bowie, Dylan, Marley. You've heard the names and maybe you've heard their songs, but what about the stories behind the records that made titans of music like these so universally loved and important? Join me, Josh Adam Myers, host of The 500, as each week I go through a different album from Rolling Stone Magazine's 500 Greatest Albums list from 2012 with an incredible lineup of comedians, actors, and musicians talking about how the music has impacted their lives. New episodes of The 500 come out every Wednesday. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
I don't think it overstates things to say that the Beatles were the greatest gift to entertainment and culture of our time, a secular religion, if you will, with their universal appeal and demonstrable impact on people's lives. I'm Robert Rodriguez, host of Something About the Beatles. With every episode, I speak with historians, musicians, artists, and Beatle witnesses, all in the service of fresh insights into the most joyous cultural entity the world has ever known. I hope you'll join me and listen to Something About the Beatles, now on Evergreen, and wherever you get your podcasts.